Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Lies We Steal by Monty J. Narrated by Grayson Owens and Lucy Rivers. Chapter 1. When Darkness Calls You Home. Alistair. I always knew I was born with a ravenous appetite for violence, destined to be the black sheep of my family. They should learn to warn others about the children that are left to cultivate with the absence of light. When you take away their luster, the darkness doesn't just become a part of them. They become the darkness. Power rippled through my arm as I felt this kid's nose shatter. My knuckles dug into the flesh of his face, chasing the only thing that could sustain my hunger. Pain. The tall, lanky moron who thought it would be a good idea to challenge me fell hard to the ground with a thud. In official mixed martial arts, you're supposed to stop when your opponent falls that hard. Fortunately for me, this is the graveyard. The abandoned racetrack on the outskirts of town, where kids gather from surrounding areas in search of trouble. Illegal street racing, fights, drugs, and half-naked girls. It's the Garden of Eden for rich kids. The grass in the middle of the cracked asphalt circle was where the fights took place, all the while engines roared and echoed, seeing whose daddy-bought machines would pass the finish line first. The graveyard is the place you come to get buried, especially if you're up against me. I charge forward, mounting him, while pressing my knee so far into his gut I could feel his organs shift below me, my agile fists heaving punch after punch to his already inflamed face. My breaths rush out methodically. Each point of contact, I let out another breath. There are hands grabbing at my shoulders, clawing at me to stop. I don't care. It only makes my knee press harder. My fists bludgeon him mercilessly. Why should I let up because he was stupid enough to step into this ring with me? Seems like a personal problem. My heart is thrashing inside my chest, the energy coursing through my veins like drums in my ears. It blends with the screams of the people around us. The revved engines, and the smell of oil. Fuck, what I would give to feel like this every second of the day. I deliver a right hook, watching as my ring imprints my initials under the tender skin of his cheek, splitting it right open above the letters AC. A gush of searing blood splatters across my chest from his face. A ferocious roar rips through me, the crimson liquid acting as gasoline to the flames inside my body. It wasn't the blood I wanted, though. I wanted his agony. I wanted to see him hurt. I wanted to know that he'd need to be carried to his car tonight, driven home, and he'd probably crawl to his fucking bed, where he'd stay for the next week, because the bruises I imprinted were too much to handle. It made chills speed down my spine. That's my not-so-secret secret. I'm always angry.
Jesus fucking Christ, Caldwell, let him up. That's enough, man.
The voice rings between my ears, but I throw one last punch before shrugging the eager hands off my skin. The circle of people around us chant for the brutality that had just taken place, the inability to turn away from tragedy or disaster. All of them are the same as me on the inside, addicted to the cruelty. They're just too afraid to admit it. I hate cowards, and every goddamn person in this fucking town is one. Monsters behind masks, terrified of their neighbors seeing the skeletons they keep shoving into their closets. What they don't know is you can't keep anything a secret in Ponderosa Springs. Not for long. I know that better than anyone. Shades of red flash behind my eyes as I stand up, hot spit coming from my mouth and landing right next to his groaning body. He's lucky he's able to make noises. Even more fortunate, he isn't dead. Besides the blood on my chest, there isn't a mark on my skin, which almost makes me angrier. Nothing challenges me anymore. I clench my jaw as I turn around, the mass of people parting like the Red Sea, leaving me an open pathway to exit.
"Money for the bets," one of the older guys running this chaotic shit presses crumpled-up bills into my chest.
I look down at it, then back at him.
"Keep it,"
I grunt. I didn't need or want that money.
He could do fuck all with it. I didn't fight for cash. I fought because if I didn't, I'd kill someone. I quickly scoop up my leather jacket, shrugging it easily over my shoulders. My t-shirt was somewhere in the muddy grass, and I didn't feel the need to search for it. My breathing begins to regulate as I make my way to my car. Even if the fight was bland, releasing even just a little of my fury would mean I could sleep tonight. With everything going on, sleep was not something I could afford to lose. Music poured from my speakers as soon as I turned the key over, the sound heavy and exhilarating. My left hand grips the wheel tightly. I can faintly see the white beneath my blood-soaked knuckles. The throb so hard that it almost feels good. I quickly throw it into gear, ready to make the drive to my parents' home. 28,000 square feet, 9 main bedrooms, 10 spares, 7 bathrooms, 26 acres, and there still isn't enough space between myself and my family. My grip tightens. I was supposed to be on a flight to the East Coast next month, putting an entire country between them and me. Instead, I'm trapped here for another year at least, chasing a ghost. Making a hard right, I turn into our driveway, one that's covered by towering trees, the paved road stopped momentarily by the large steel gate blocking the entrance. I click the button on my remote to automatically open them, pulling past them and into my family's estate. Pulling around the tacky marble fountain in front, I slide into my parking spot easily. None of the usual cars are here, meaning no one's home. It wouldn't matter anyway. Even when they are here, I'm invisible to them. I always have been. Lightning cracks across the sky behind the house, lighting up the fog for a split second, before thunder rattles the ground beneath my feet as I walk towards the door. The keypad glows under my touch, entering my passcode and stepping inside. When my parents and brother are here, the house is shining with light. Its glow can be seen through the trees on the road. Extravagant parties, celebrating a clipped toenail, family dinners that I'm never invited to, and when they are gone, it's just me and the dark. My boots echo off the floor, step by step, until I'm in the kitchen turning the faucet on. I run my swollen hands beneath the lukewarm water. The blood begins to flow down the drain. Some of it, anyway. There is some stuck between my fingers, already dried. There shouldn't be noise inside the house. It should be how it always is when I'm here. Dead silence. Except there isn't. My ears twitch, picking up on the familiar click, followed by a whoosh at the lighting of the flint. "Trying to scare me?" I say out loud, drying my hand slowly before I turn around. I peer into the dark of the parlor room, Rook's face illuminated by the single flame of his Zippo as he flips it across his knuckles and through his fingers. I spot the single diamond strike match resting in his mouth, the scarlet tip peeping out of the side. He's leaning back in the leather-beveled chair, arms resting on the sides as he stares at me through the dark. "If I was, you wouldn't have heard me," he retorts. I navigate myself into the chair across from him, pulling the lamp string, illuminating the room in an amber glow. Just as I sink into the stale material, resting my arms on my knees, I hear footsteps approach behind me. I don't bother looking over my shoulder. "Thatch?" I greet, as I see his shadow walk past me, taking the seat to our left. At 6'4", Thatcher is the tallest one of the group, not like he needs his size to scare anyone. He slings one leg over the other, his ankle resting on his knee. "Get your rocks off, battering some poor kid's head in, Allie?" I grind my teeth. The pompous asshole knew I hated being called that. Known that as long as we've been friends. But it wouldn't be him if he wasn't trying to get underneath someone's skin. You see, Thatcher's veins were constantly pumping with ice water, and mine were always boiling. "You really want to talk about what gets people off, Thatcher?" I raise one eyebrow at him, taking in his Armani suit. I'd learned to stop questioning his extravagant wardrobe a long time ago. "I wouldn't want to give you nightmares." He smirks, and I can't help the matching one that appears on mine. I'd be lying if I said I haven't wanted to rip each of their heads off at some point. We knew how to push each other's buttons. However, right now, I was reminded of how I'd kill anyone who'd tried to do the same. It's why I'm willing to stay in this godforsaken town, because one of our own had been scorned. "Where is Silas?" I ask. "Sleeping for the first time in, fuck, I don't even know," Rook answers.
"Don't be naive, Rook. Silas doesn't sleep anymore. When he does, he sees her. We all know that,"
Thatcher interjects, reminding us all why we are here in the first place. The grandfather clock in the hallway chimes, signaling that midnight has reached us. The weight of his words pilfers into the room. The wrath I'd just tried to release earlier started to creep back up. I could feel the flames licking my heels, the copper taste in my mouth.
"Speaking of her,"
Rook reaches forward, tossing a cream-colored folder onto the table in the middle of all of us. Perks of being the district attorney's son. I lean forward, grabbing it up.
"You look inside yet?"
He shakes his head.
"Wanted to wait until we were together."
Raising up a bit, he reaches into his back pocket, grabbing the white pack of cigarettes. Pulling a single one out, raking a hand through his long brown hair.
"Mind?"
he asks, referring to the smoke. "Burn it down for all I care," I say honestly. Rook leans back in the chair, pulling the match from his mouth and lighting it with his fingers, a trick he'd taught himself when we were at summer camp. He lights the end, inhaling deeply, a cloud of smoke gathering around his face. Since I was 6 years old, the only things I've ever cared about was Rook, Thatcher, and Silas. We'd sworn to protect each other always, even if it meant wreaking havoc on others in the process. Nothing else mattered besides them, to any of us. You never see one of us without the others. We are the kids that were never made to be good. We were always meant to be crooked and broken.
"We are all aware of what will happen when we start looking into this, correct?"
Thatch says.
"There will be blood on all of our hands. Not just the little destruction we've done around town all our lives. We won't be burning down historic churches or playing wicked games. We will be killing someone."
We should flinch or cringe at the idea of taking someone's life. But we all knew what each other was capable of. It's their own fault. They should have known better than to hurt someone we care about. I remember that night. I remember the smell of that house we found her in. Like pig shit and vomit. A trap house where druggies hide out and shoot their liquid gold. I remember what her body looked like. Bent and left hopelessly on the filthy ground. Like an angel who'd gotten lost and found herself in hell. She didn't deserve to die there. And Silas didn't deserve to find her like that. I could still hear his screams when I shut my eyes. Hours and hours of shouts. A wounded beast whose pain was growling into unfiltered rage. An emotion that coursed through all of us. We find out who did it. We end them, and we can move on. We'll be able to move forward.
He won't move on, I shake my head.
Even if we find what we're looking for. You don't move on from something like this. I open the folder, revealing the white pages stuck between. The patient's name in black bold letters that make my jaw twitch. Rosemary Page Donahue. My eyes scan through the report, all the questions asked. Was the patient's death expected? No. Was ACLS performed? Yes. By one of my best friends, until we pulled him off her, I note. Flipping to the next page, I find the drawing of a body from the front and back. But instead of having circles around certain areas like I assumed it would, it was blank. My eyebrows inch together as I read the coroner's findings. No visible signs of trauma or contusions. So the scratch marks on her hands? The purple circles from the obvious bruising on her arms? I saw those. They were there. The most significant finding on the autopsy was the presences of methylene dioxymethamphetamine, MDMA, in the patient's system. After a thorough investigation, it is my conclusion that the amount ingested caused heat stroke in the patient. The core body temperature was raised, leading to cardiac arrest, which led to death. No foul play was detected. So the dirt underneath her fingernails, like she'd been clawing at something. That was just a coincidence. The police didn't investigate further into the fact Rose had never touched drugs up to that point. There were things that weren't adding up. That wasn't sitting right with me. Here, genius, you read it. Tell me what you think. I toss the files at Thatcher, watching as he rests his hand on his chin while his eyes scan across the paper. No evidence of foul play? No documentation of the bruises or the marks on her skin? He says out loud, and I nod in silent agreement. We saw her body. I don't know about you two, but I've got 20/20 vision. Rose was not there on her own free will, nor did she die willingly. She never even went to parties with us, made Cy stay home with her all the time. Is Ponderosa Springs really trying to hide the murder of the mayor's daughter? Rook comments, taking another puff of his cancer stick, one that I'm about to steal for myself. Rose was not only Silas's girlfriend. She'd become one of us. Slowly, she'd weaseled her way into our group, making herself a friend. We wouldn't admit it out loud, but we all cared for her like a sister. Her death was eating at all of us. Wouldn't be the worst scandal here. So, if a pathologist would lie about something like defense wounds and foul play, what else is he covering up? Better yet, who is he covering up for? Thatcher asks. I think we should pay the good doctor a visit. I scan my eyes across my two friends. Rook's mouth quirking up into a smile as he flips his Zippo across his fingers, snapping it shut. Don't have to tell me twice, he mutters. Thatcher grins sharply. As long as I get to cut first. We made a deal. A promise to one of our best friends that we'd figure out who did this to his girl. Left her dead and dirty. All of us giving up our plans to leave this toxic place for an entire year just to get the revenge he needed. Not even God could save the people who got in the way of that.
Chapter 2. Through the Fog. Briar.
We are all thieves, Briar. I just got caught.
That's what my father used to tell me every time he was whisked off in the back of a police car. To an extent, he was right. We're all thieves. We steal air from the atmosphere so that we can breathe. We steal happiness. We steal lighters. There is no such thing as, hey, man, can I just borrow your lighter? If you believe they are going to give it back, well, you're just an idiot with one less lighter. But most of us, all of us, really, we steal time. We aren't owed any set number of minutes on this earth, yet we take it anyway. Every day you wake up is another day yanked from the inside of the hourglass. I was 11 by the time I learned how to pickpocket. Nearly a professional, I'd mastered the art of 7 bells within 6 months, and soon I'd become a criminal prodigy. So, while my mother was flipping burgers, my father would set up mannequins all dressed in men's suits, strewn with pockets, and they would be rigged with 7 strategically placed bells. My goal was to pick the mannequin clean without ringing a single bell. I was his mini-me, his pride and joy, his little criminal. I had dexterity, speed, and I was agile. Pickpocketing, lockpicking, safe-cracking, all the things to make a perfect crook I'd excelled at by 13. Other little girls learned ballet. I could break into a fire safe without breaking a sweat. I mean, hell, there wasn't a lot I couldn't do. Even when he'd first started guiding me, I knew it was wrong. Stealing was bad. Everyone knew that. But those moments I spent with my dad, those late nights perfected my technique and were the best time of my life. His profession kept the lights on, food on the table. It kept my family together. Yeah, some families probably bonded over board games. Mine bonded over larceny.
There is honor among thieves, Briar. Honor among us.
I'd been used to him going in and out of jail, spending a few months here and there. But he always came back to me. He promised he'd always come back to us. But one day he didn't. My moral compass never did have true north. Maybe it was why I was always so curious about things I shouldn't be. I was aware that my behavior is not socially ethical, but I didn't regret anything I'd ever done. I did it for my mom. I was working with the skills I'd been given. When life gives you lemons, steal a fucking juicer.
Are you excited about this fresh start? It's a huge deal they accepted you, even with my recommendation. They like to accept locals only.
My Uncle Thomas, my mother's brother, speaks to me for the first time since the plane ride. He's shy like that. My mom says it's because he was born crooked, all that knowledge and no social skills. I always liked him, though, since he gave great Christmas gifts. Instead of talking, he was always paying attention to the little things. It sounds more like a cult than a school, T. It probably was a cult. Actually, I know it's a freaking cult. It's the only university in the States with enough money and power to only accept people in the area, alumni students, or children who came from extremely wealthy families. Everyone with their head out from under a rock knew about Hollow Heights. How does a thief with a record, split ends, and barely two dimes to rub together get accepted? That's a good damn question. It had little to do with my 4.0, high test scores, and extensive athletic ability. And everything to do with the fact Thomas was the biology professor and had been for the past 3 years. My uncle was somewhere in his late 30s, the youngest of the two siblings. My mother and him had grown up poor all their life, just like me. Except when Thomas turned 18, he tucked tail and ran far away from his family. Came back years later with a snazzy degree and a Rolex. No, I didn't try to steal it.
It's not nearly as pretentious as you are imagining. It's surprisingly down to earth, he says with a smile.
I scoff. The brochure included an entire segment on how a prince, an actual Scottish prince, graduated from there. It looks like every single Ivy League school came together and had an orgy. I yawn a bit.
You're going to look at me and tell me that place isn't filled to the brim with entitled rich kids with Amex cards?
I cross my arms across my chest, staring at him with one eyebrow raised. Don't get me wrong. I'm thankful to be attending. The education I'll receive from here will guarantee me a job after I graduate. I'm just not excited to be the scholarship kid. It's a lot like being the brown paper lunch bag kid, or the one who picks their boogers and eats them. It's not a good look.
Don't be so judgmental. There might be quite a few people here who don't have a ton of money, Briar. This is going to be the greatest 4 years of your life, I promise.
He reaches over, squeezing my hand reassuringly, and I wasn't aware how badly I'd actually needed that. The longer we drove down this unending entranceway towards the imminent black gates, the worse my nerves got. While it was a dream to be accepted, this place looked a whole lot like a nightmare. I stared out of my window at the baby raindrops that clung to the glass. I inspected the rows and rows of pine trees. At any moment, it seemed they would reach forward and grab the car. The sun used the wet clouds as a guard, so that every single moment here felt gray, void of all colors, vacant of warmth. It seemed to me, anyway, these kids were paying a shitload of money to live inside a Stephen King novel. I cleared my throat, sitting up a little straighter, tugging my hoodie up on my head and placed my headphones in my ears, trying to settle my stomach. The eerie silence that had settled around us was giving me serious haunted house vibes. Even with the music playing, I could hear the gravel crunching beneath the tires as he continued to drive inside the campus. The first piece of the college you see, welcoming all new students and returning ones, was a large weathered brick arch with a mocking metal plaque bolted to the front. The rust and ivy attempted to shield the written words on it, but it was no use. Hollow Heights University, established 1634. We invited success. The name was engraved boldly, bearing its name to all who enter. Where the leather-bound books whisper in dead languages, and the empty marbled hallways creaked with defiance. The light never touches the ground. A constant blanket of fog dances through the towering pines. The infamous university for wealthy boys and girls, one of the most secluded and elite colleges in history. It's rumored to have homed some of the wealthiest young minds in the country. Hollow Heights ensured parents would not be disappointed after their child completed the program here. They would return after graduation diplomatic and refined, ready to take on any job thrown their way. The college was situated on the coast of Oregon,
300 acres of Victorian architecture that felt older than dirt. I toured it online, but the computer didn't do it justice. The town it was built in was Ponderosa Springs, known for, you guessed it, the pine trees of the same name. I didn't know a lot of its history, except that it was filled with wealthy families. You had to drive through it in order to reach the campus, and it wasn't very large. Whether it was on purpose or by accident, the architects of the school had made this place feel miles and miles from any real type of civilization. It was like its own world beyond the trees built on somber wetland that made me queasy. You know, like after you eat gas station sushi.
Your thing is freaking me out again with its beady red eyes, Thomas says, as he pulls up to the drop-off spot for the dorms.
I peep down at the small animal in my hands, her pure white fur soft underneath my fingers, and her little nose stuck up in the air, smelling her surroundings. Her name is Ada, and she is not a thing. She is an albino Dumbo rat. If you call her a thing again, she's going to bite you. I warn, even though I know, and so does Ada, she wouldn't harm a fly. When my dad let me pick out a pet when I was young, I chose a rat. Not because I was trying to be different or outside of the box, but because there was just something uber cool about rats. I'd had three, each of them living to their expected lifespan of 2-ish years before they died. I waited a few months to mourn, cried every time, and then I started looking for a new companion. Ada and I have been going strong for about a year now.
Do you need help gathering your bags to your room, or do you think you can manage?
He asks from the driver's seat. I look out at the dorm, Iruine District, where all the lower classmen stayed. A circular water fountain rested in the center, a large saint, I believe, doubling as a water spit. The cracked marble made me feel he'd crumble at any second. Crows squawked from above, their black wings darting through the haze. My eyes trying to count the number of gargoyles that stood guard on top of the pedestals and pilings. I wave him off. I can handle it. Thanks, though. I open the door, tucking Ada into my hoodie pocket where she stays most of the time when she isn't in her cage. I automatically wish I had thrown on a pair of jeans instead of these athletic shorts. I'm not used to the cold. Texas didn't have cold weather, or this much fog. Walking to the trunk of the car, I lift it up, placing my book bag on my shoulders, grabbing my suitcase. A cold gust of wind runs across my back, like something had ran across my back. I turn my head slightly, gazing over at the buildings, expecting to see someone standing there, expecting to see someone staring in my direction. But I was only met with students shuffling across school grounds, lugging their suitcases inside.
You all right?
Thomas asks beside me. Yeah. I shake my head, smiling. I'm good.
This is going to be really great for you. I just have this feeling.
He rubs his hands together.
Here is your dorm key and lunch card. If you need anything, you have my number. My apartment is off campus in town, but it's a short drive, so don't hesitate to ask.
He wraps an arm around my shoulder, giving me the most awkward side hug in history. Thank you, Uncle T. Affection wasn't something I was huge on to begin with. You can't be poor and soft. I should have been nervous walking towards a school that makes Harvard look like a backwoods community college, but I wasn't. It wasn't in my nature to be nervous or scared. When you live the life I've lived, the one where you have to fight for your survival, the meals on your table, the roof above your head, you don't have time to be afraid of anything. You do what needs to be done.
Chapter 3 Way Down We Go. Alistair. Took you too long enough, I mumble, pushing myself off my car with my boot, tossing my cigarette onto the ground, stomping out the dying ember.
Thatcher had to press his suit.
Silas shoves into Thatcher's body with his shoulder, his body covered with an entirely black hoodie, the moonlight reflecting off his hardened face. Versace? To a crime scene? A bit pretentious, even for you. I eye his outfit, looking like he's attending some fucking political debate about global warming or healthcare.
Good to see you don't hate Mommy and Daddy too much. Seems you at least learned your brands from them.
His voice levels. We know you oppose all things wealth, Alistair, but there is
Sample complete. Ready to continue?